And so now it begins, our mixture of special guests with special topics, six of them, as a matter of fact. And the first one up will be Stephen Quayle. We'll be back with Stephen in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, his name is Stephen Quayle. He's the author of a primer for understanding bioterrorism called Breathe No Evil, first published in 1996. For the past 8-9 years, Quayle has articulated the need for all of us to be aware of bioterrorism and weapons of mass destruction. And upon publication of Breathe No Evil, Quayle upstaged mainstream media by years, spelling out detailed effects of bioterrorism. And he continues to shout concerning the massive loss of life due to the lack of civil defense and preparedness in the public and private sectors. He's our first guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Stephen, this is a momentous occasion with six different guests with six different topics. So I'm glad you have elected to join us, and you're the first. How are you?
Well, good. Thank you for asking me to be on with you tonight, George.
You know, you have done a lot of work into civil defense preparedness of the public and private sectors. I have got to get your reaction to what you witnessed with Hurricane Katrina.
Well, what I witnessed with Hurricane Katrina is, sadly, is the total lack of communication as to the nature of the threat and the total lack of preparation in dealing with the basics of a city such as New Orleans that is so low, and basically I think it was the most fouled up undertaking, and literally for unfortunately a couple thousand people, that was a good word, undertaking, that has ever been done. You know, people who rely on the federal government to get them out of harm's way, I believe are automatically in harm's way, and I think that Katrina and Rita are showing that we need to be very much prepared on our own as individual citizens, that we need to help our neighbors, and I am afraid the massive exodus out of Houston is a good example of this, that people technically wait until the last minute, although it appears that Hurricane Rita is having materials and emergency personnel sent in way ahead of time. I think that it's just indicative, George, of the true sad nature of the lack of civil defense. There is no, in my opinion, functional civil defense in the United States of America today.
Can there be, Stephen?
Yes. But it cannot come on a government level. It has to come on an individual, a community level. It has to be broken down, not on so much of a macro scale, but onto more of a micro scale. And community civil defense has been proven. Even the communities in New Orleans, the parishes that fared well, were the ones that stuck together, pulled together as Americans. And basically, they had a different story to tell than the refugees.
Now, is your definition of civil defense, Stephen, preparedness before the tragic event or ongoing, even afterwards?
Well, it's an ongoing thing. I think, first of all, civil defense is a preparedness mentality. I think our forefathers, it's just the practical pioneer spirit that made this country great. It's being prepared for the eventualities that you can prepare for, especially if you're in a high-stress area. It's just like California right now, George. Obviously, you've been seeing the earthquakes that have been taking place in the area around Mettler, California, mm-hmm. and there have been 40 EQs today. But what's fascinating about Mettler, though, is its relationship to the San Joaquin Valley and the seawall that has always been identified by geologists as being a potential hazard should that rupture. In essence, the San Joaquin Valley in the old days, most people don't know this, but the California was known on the older maps as the Isles of California. And so I think that this is a real heads up for the people on the West Coast that this is not just something that is, let's say, a disturbance. This could be something that is more dangerous. Let me give you a good example. In Kobe, the Kobe earthquake, a lot of the scientists and a lot of eyewitnesses observed different ground effects of lightning, ball lightning, even strange auroras. So this is the same thing that took place in the famous Tangshan, China earthquake of 1976, which killed over 650,000 people. And for the first time, I know that Stan Deo was telling me the other day that he was called by some geologists in California And they're actually describing lightning that emanates from the ground to the ionosphere, not the other way around. Now, this is pretty amazing, because when you start to see that history has recorded different lightning bursts or different electromagnetic aerial phenomena associated with major earthquakes such as the Kobe, such as the Tangshan, China, then it starts to take on a little more ominous nature. It's one thing to have a piezoelectric effect, in other words, just the static electricity being generated by different minerals as they move against each other in friction. But what we're hearing descriptions of is literally ground-emanating lightning bolts. Now, that's pretty unusual. And then if you take into account that the people in Florida saw a massive fireball, you may have dealt with that the other night.
Yeah, I had that on, yes.
Yeah, and you take these things together, it becomes even more perilous. The Japanese Seismic Institute and a lot of the Japanese seismologists are really paying attention to this effect. They actually watch the different frequencies that are generated from the different transmitters, such as HARP. And most people talk about HARP all the time, but they don't understand that there's probably 14 of those transmitters called ionospheric heaters. And then when you take into conjunction the gamma ray bursts that are coming from the center of the Milky Way and the proton storms that are hitting our atmosphere, you basically get a supersaturated ionosphere, and then you almost get a capacitor-like effect. So, well, the science, we'll let the mainstream scientists fight out whether they want to accept this or not. We're seeing disturbing indications right now that the earthquakes on the West Coast, the lava that's building under, obviously, Bend, Oregon, that's 100 square miles, all of these things taken together with the slippage of the different plates are indicative that this civil defense idea that, you know, I keep trying to pound and pound and sound the alarm over is really critical at this point. And I think, unfortunately, we as Americans will focus on civil defense until one incident happens, and then we let it go and we go back to our normal life. I think what Hurricane Katrina, Rita, and the coming great quakes, and I mean great quakes, 8 and 9s, are going to prove is that it's going to have to be a permanent state of mind and a permanent state of preparedness. And again, I think the government has done a very shabby job of getting people, even in the preparedness mindset. You and I have talked on air so many times about a 72-hour kit. A 72-hour kit's good, but it's not enough. And I think that, again, the refugee status, the web bots of the if you will, the people that go out and search the entire internet for the common thought patterns and common word patterns. They're talking about 13 million refugees, George.
And if go ahead.
I'm sorry. And if you look at some of their hits, George Ur of Urban Survival and Cliff at Half Past Human, I mean, they have some pretty phenomenal track record of saying, look, this is what's going to happen, whether it was the mud and the flow in New Orleans. What I think it's the consciousness of the people that are typing, whatever stories are being written. When I put stuff up on the internet, obviously I have a thought, you have a thought, the Coast website, my website, other websites, we all are expressing what we see, what we feel, and you take that collectively and you can get a pretty good feel of almost, if you will, the subterranean or the under the surface themes that are running in the thought patterns. And I think this is really important for people to understand. We've got, if I would have told you and you would have told me prior to Hurricane Katrina that we'd have 250,000 refugees, we wouldn't believe it, probably.
But not in this country. We wouldn't believe it.
Not in this country. But now if I say we're going to have 13 million refugees due to some amazing geological instability coupled with some very startling and striking phenomenological events, and I think that people have got to understand that 13 million refugees is a problem that isn't just six times what we're seeing in Katrina, but it multiplies exponentially.
Well, you know, even with these ground-emitting lightning bolts you talk about, and I had a call Friday from someone during Open Lines whose life has been affected by something like this. He doesn't know what it was, but he said he was out with his five other friends and this huge pulsating burst of light came and hit them all. It could have been one of these ground-emitting lightning bolts, and because they all got sick, it's affected all of them. Something's happening, Stephen, to this planet. for all of this to be occurring at the same time. Since this tsunami hit on December 26, we have had nothing but major league catastrophes. Yes, we've had hurricanes before that, and we're going to have hurricanes after it. But for all of this to be happening around the same time period, it's scary. What do you think is going on with the planet?
Well, first of all, I believe we're living in a period of time that, whether you take the ancients and their end time stories, if you take the Book of Revelation, if you take even the Mayans' prognostications about the year 2012, I believe that this world is, that we've known and come to love and we all have to live on, is undergoing extreme changes. And those changes, I believe, are absolutely indicative of the forces that would normally be occurring, but I believe that obviously you reap what you sow, and you know that gets into the whole cosmological implications. Are we doing something in this country that's wrong, that the judgment, and let's just call it judgment, that can be my word, no one has to agree with it, that the judgment seems to be building towards a crescendo. And to the people that would deny that, you've got to look at some of the things that are taking place, even in the real markets of gasoline. You know, for people to say there's no inflation, I mean, I don't know what you guys are paying in California right now. I'm assuming it's over $3 a gallon.
It's over $3 in California, and it just went under that in St. Louis about a week ago. It's like $2.80, $2.85, right around there. I was going to ask you that. I mean, what is happening to us as a nation? Because I keep waking up every morning, Stevens, and looking at these catastrophes, saying, why us? I mean, this isn't happening now in some of these other areas. I mean, it seems to be all focused on the United States.
Well, I think if you look at the United States, I believe that a nation reaps what it sows. And, you know, again, when you're dealing with the situation of the United States, and I love this country, but I also know that there are things that we're doing that are absolutely wrong. And I don't want to get into that right now because we don't have the time to go into it. But I believe that, again, if you look at the Book of Revelation, you see the cosmic war between good and evil. And I believe there really is an entity, as you know, the devil, that wants to destroy mankind. I believe there's a battle going on, and that battle is both supernatural and it manifests itself in the natural realm in the way of earthquakes, hurricanes.
Is it possible that negative energy, tremendous negative energy, which is offset, of course, by positive energy, but for some reason, somebody is sending bursts of negative energy our way, and it's affecting us?
Well, first of all, you know, again, whether historically or not, there are certain behaviors, there are certain attitudes, there are certain actions, you know. I mean, there are things that, obviously, I believe that God holds nations accountable in time and space for their iniquity. And I believe that, you know, people say, well, why would God let this happen to America? Well, it's simple, because we've kicked them out of everything that you can kick them out of, and then people want to go around with a bumper sticker that says, God bless America, and my answer to that is, why and what does it take to get God to bless America? What's changed in this country versus, you know, even 5 years ago or even 2 years ago? And I think that there is cause and effect, George, and I think that it's time that this country assesses where we are at and says, look, we are doing something incredibly wrong. And forgive me, not just something. In my opinion, we're doing a lot of things wrong. You just can't go on, and I believe that it's the mercy of God that brings him to ultimately cause people to stop. Now, I don't know if you saw the story. Let me give you a good example. Wolf Blitzer, I believe, on CNN was announcing, and I think so are some of the other Fox people and CNN people, that there's a potential that if Hurricane Rita hits Texas like they suspect, we could go for a period of 3 weeks to 4 weeks in the United States without gas. It's unbelievable to most people to believe, especially California. Let's face it, Californians, more so than probably anybody in the country, live in their vehicles. They go to and from places. If we were cut off from gas, and I'm talking gasoline, because of the refineries being shut down, it would be a time of, I would say, serious introspection. You know, again, nations, in my opinion, obviously get judged in time and history, and I think that America's got to go into a deep introspective mode to say what we are, to basically say, what are we doing that would infuriate the God that we're asking to bless this country? What are we doing? And I, you know, obviously I can name off a litany of things, but I
think we may learn how to live without gasoline, though. That might be a good thing.
Well, you know, again, I'm not a you know, anti-technology, but as you know, I believe that the technology that has been given to us by, you know, fallen angels and supernatural entities is designed to destroy us. I've quoted, you know, so many times, Jesus said, if the days weren't shortened, there'd be no flesh left alive. If you look at the genetic manipulation, if you go into the myths of Atlantis and the great civilizations of prehistory, when they started messing around with human beings and crossing them with animals, look, that's enough. But if you, you know, you're a student of ancient history, you know that when mankind started to go into that realm, there seemed to be judgment. And it was either volcanic, it was either earthquakes, hurricanes, what they call the whirlwinds in the Old Testament time. So we're reaping, and I don't believe it's over by any means. And I, again, I'm telling people that, you know, if they live in a dangerous area, and obviously California, you know, they've joked and joked and joked about the big one, but it's fascinating to me now that seeing the earthquakes that are so strategically placed in California, and I say that from a standpoint of flooding the San Joaquin Valley and turning a lot of Southern California into oceanfront property inland, I think that it's really behooves people to go into a personal assessment mode and say, okay, what is going on in this country? What has changed? And no one can deny, like you say, that there's an accelerated mode going place. And listen, global warming, you know, there's more to global warming than just basically cows and methane gas emissions. We've had some of the most dramatic solar flares, solar prominences, coronal mass ejections, gamma ray bursts, and every day it's like a new phenomenon is being at least discovered or identified. And in all this, it seems like planet Earth is getting bombarded, and I think it's time, seriously, for people to consider their ways. And again, I stand on the record and go on the record as saying that God, the living God, has a controversy with the United States of America, and it doesn't matter who our elected leaders think they are, they better realize that they're not God, because when they play God and they make decisions in that realm, and I think that they've bit off more than they can chew. And again, it's not a political statement; it's a reality statement. What does it take?
But are you saying we're being punished by good, or are we being attacked by evil?
I would say it's a conflict between good and evil, and I would say the battlefield has become not just only Earth, but specifically the United States. Look, if there is a God that is personal, that has created man in his image, then he's given mankind specific requirements to, you know, to be blessed and prosper. And I can only say this, that these type of events are only reiterating or mirroring, in my opinion, America's tragic lack of reality. Listen, we should be loving each other, not killing each other. And as you know, I'm not I do my best to try and get people's lives saved, not destroyed. So, you know, it's amazing, isn't it? When we had a War Department, we didn't have so much internal problems. Now we've got a Defense Department. It seems like in so many ways the American people have become the enemy. And I know you'll have Alex on talking about that. Alex has done probably one of the best jobs of showing where we're really headed as a nation. And quite candidly, I'm no fan of the Third Reich, and I'm certainly an opponent of the Fourth and Fifth Reich. And I'm talking about now the inevitability of us losing our freedoms that our forefathers have fought for and died for. And I'm very concerned that this country, people had better wake up and realize that we have lost the very true, wonderful nature of our foundation. In my opinion, when we honored God, we were blessed. In my opinion, we dishonor God. And now the fight, and you ask me the question, is it good and evil? It's both. God does judge supernaturally in time and space wickedness. The devil is out to destroy mankind. Therefore, there has to be a break in this. And I can only say this. I can't stop what's going to happen, but I can help people get out of harm's way and get prepared.
Well, you're not holding back. Stephen, thanks. Appreciate you being on the program. Stephen's website, all guests' websites are linked up with their names on coasttocoastam.com. Up next, Howard Bloom, the human computer. NASA's new plans for moon missions, and much more. Well, how would you like to read about werewolves, vampires, psychics, all of that in the After Dark newsletter? And to subscribe, you call 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. And when you do, when you subscribe or renew, you get a free CD. It's called Perfect Possession, Art Bell's interview with Father Malachi Martin. 1-888-727-5505 online, coasttocoastam.com. Up next, Howard Bloom on Coast to Coast AM. Howard Bloom almost single-handedly carved out two new fields, paleopsychology and mass behavior. His next goal is to establish a field he calls omnology. Bloom helped shape the careers of Prince, John Cougar Mellencamp, Bette Midler, Billy Joel, and many others. Howard is a visiting scholar graduate in the psychology department at New York University and a founder of the International Paleopsychology Project and the Big Bang Tango Media Lab. And he's our special guest on Coast to Coast. Howard, it's about time you and I chat again. How are you?
George, how have you been?
I'm doing great.
It's good to talk to you, but I've got a question for you.
Yeah.
What did you think, how did you feel when you saw on Tuesday NASA's new plan for putting man on the moon?
I thought we were a little late with something like that. I don't understand why we were there in 1969 through 72, and it's going to take us so long to get back. It was weird.
And how did you feel about when you looked at the pictures? Didn't you have a sense of deja vu all over again?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I remember exactly where I was on that July day in 1969.
And you know what this plan is being called in the space community?
What's that?
It's being called Apollo on steroids.
Yeah,
in other words,
that's true.
Many, many, many decades after Apollo, suddenly we're doing a rerun of the Apollo program. Now, why in the world are we doing this? And why in the world do they say that it's Apollo on steroids? Now, do you remember how many people had said we're going to get to the moon at a time?
Four.
Yes, four. How did you feel about that?
Well, you know, that's double what we did before. I mean, we sent two down to the moon. Now we're going to send four down to the moon. You know what? I don't know. That I didn't think too much about.
Well, I was hideously disappointed.
Okay.
And I have been conspiring with a friend down at the National Science Foundation. The National Science Foundation is the Vatican of the sciences. And this friend, for some kind reason, pulled me in as a moral supporter on an alternative space program. This was about 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
I called him the day that the announcement came out because I felt horrible and I couldn't exactly pinpoint why, and asked him how he felt. And his words were incredibly depressed. And he was incredibly depressed because there's a very, very strong option, and it's the one that he's been pushing and that I've been giving him moral support on, and it's been totally overlooked in all of this. And it's the use of a reusable space plane. It's the most amazing thing that you've ever seen. I mean, this thing is a plane made entirely with flat surfaces, which we've now become accustomed to thanks to the various stealth aircraft we've got.
Mm-hmm.
When you have flat surfaces made of carbon fiber, they're much less expensive to produce than curved surfaces. So that cuts down on cost tremendously. It uses a form of diffusion-bonded honeycomb thermal insulation. Now, to put that in English, in order to get into space is one big challenge, but to get back from space is an even bigger challenge.
As the shuttle showed us.
Right, exactly. And you know that things easily burn up coming back home. The diffusion-bonded honeycomb is something that protects you against the intense heat of reentry, and it's been, because it's now about 15 to 20 years old, it's gone through two different manufacturing stages, and the latest manufacturing stage has made it very, very inexpensive. So what you've got here is a space plane that can take another expense, by the way, of getting into space, is maintaining the facilities to get your vehicle into space.
Mm-hmm.
For example, maintaining the facilities down at Cape Canaveral, or whatever we're calling it this year, is very, very expensive. If you can use an existing facility, then you have saved yourself a ton of money. This particular reusable space plane can take off from Vandenberg Air Force Base, which is constantly in use anyway.
Right.
It can also land again at Vandenberg Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's look across for a second. Using the new heavy liftoff vehicle that has not yet been developed but is being proposed for this new Mission to Moon program, it's a thoroughly disposable vehicle. Once you've used it, you throw it away. I mean, this is the ultimate in space litter. With the space plane, you don't throw it away. You reuse it over and over again.
You just maintain it, that's all.
Right. With the reusable vehicle, I mean, with the vehicle that they're talking about in the NASA program, it costs you $3,000 a pound to get cargo into orbit. Now, ready for this? That's $3,000 a pound. Keep that figure in mind.
I will.
With the space plane, it's $200 a pound.
$200 compared to $3,000?
That's right.
That's dramatic.
And that is assuming that we don't run into cost overruns on building this behemoth, this massive vehicle that is planned for the new moon program.
Okay, Bill, how are you going to land this vehicle, the one you're talking about, on the moon?
Well, you don't. You use it to achieve the both vehicles, that is, the vehicle and the current NASA spam in a can strategy, and the reusable space plane only get you up to suborbital heights.
Okay.
And then you use a subsequent vehicle to take you up in the moon plan. In the NASA moon plan, you use another vehicle to take you up to actual orbit, and then you do another burn on it, and you get to into orbit around the moon.
Well, now, where's that vehicle? Is that vehicle stashed in the cargo bay of this new vehicle?
This vehicle carries a 10-ton payload, and with a 10-ton payload, you can carry something called a Boeing X-37. And a Boeing X-37 is an entirely autonomous vehicle. In other words, it can drive itself, which then carries your astronauts up to wherever in the world you want to take them. Now, there's an important intermediate step here. The people who've conceived the alternative plan want to make space pay for itself. So their goal is to take up the units for a space-based solar array, which would then be robotic, and the units that you take up then assemble themselves like Lego pieces.
Okay.
Into a giant solar array. Then using a laser, which is under development, I mean, all these things are currently being funded. Using a laser, you beam the power back down to Earth. Now, why in the world do you do that? Because we're heavily dependent on imports of Middle Eastern oil, mm-hmm. and we need a new energy source of some sort.
And Venezuelan oil.
Yes, and Venezuela, where Chavez is not particularly fond of us. And also Nigeria. Have you followed what's happening in Nigeria in the last 24 hours?
That's going to be a disaster as well.
It's going to be a major disaster because right now there's an Islamic group that's trying to take over the oil fields. And we're talking about native Nigerian Muslims who are trying to take over the oil fields. So we have three pinch points right now. We're very vulnerable in the Gulf because we've got another hurricane coming. We're very vulnerable in Venezuela, and we're very vulnerable in Nigeria. So we desperately need an alternative energy source. The purpose that Paul Werbos, my friend at the National Science Foundation, who's the program director for Control Networks and Computational Intelligence, his goal is to make space pay for itself. And one of the ways of making space pay for itself is by beaming down an entirely different energy source.
It sounds I love the idea. I think it's great.
But that's not the only way of paying off. You know, once I've sold you my fancy new whatever it is, I have to throw in the Ginzu knives, right? Well, the Ginzu knives in this case are space tourism. If you can launch tourists into space, not for the huge amounts of money, first of all, we got to give the Russians credit. They are making space pay.
Pay handily. What are they charging? $25 million
a shot.
Yeah.
And instead of $20 million a shot, I do not know what the retail price is. I have to confess ignorance on that. But when you cut the cost down from $3,000 a pound to $200 a pound, imagine what increase you get in the potential number of people you can take into space as tourists.
Retail stores would love that markup percentage, Howard.
Yes, exactly. So the point is, you have two ways of getting the space program to pay for itself. Then you head for the moon. Now, with the existing plan, the plan that NASA announced 2 days ago, I wish we had the photos in front of you so I could show you this. You take the massive booster, you get it to reach suborbital velocity, and then what do? You throw it away, this immensely expensive device.
Yes.
You then take another stage and send it up to Earth orbit and take it in orbit around the moon, and you throw that away. You then put a lander on the moon, and you have four guys walk around putting new fingerprints on, or new footsteps on the moon, nothing we haven't done before, possibly taking a golf club and a golf ball with them once again.
Maybe coming back with a few more samples.
Yes, with a few extra rocks. And you have them traipsing around up there with nothing really to do, except send out a press release every now and then. And then they get back into an even smaller little device, and they leave behind them one of those spidery-looking lunar landers that looks almost exactly like the Apollo lander, and guess what that's good for once you leave it behind?
There it stays.
Nothing. It's good for nothing. I mean, your goal, Robert Zubrin has pointed the way. You probably know his work. Robert Zubrin.
Oh, yeah, he's been on the show.
Yeah, he's the one who's utterly rethought how to get to Mars. And one of the tricks to the way Robert Zubrin does things is you don't leave things behind that are garbage. Everything you leave behind is part of an infrastructure. Everything you leave on the moon has to be part of a space base. Now, if you go over, because I've done this, if you go over the press releases and the fact sheets and all of the pictures that NASA put out, and it put out a wonderful series of pictures 2 days ago, you discover that there is tons of rhetoric about establishing a permanent manned base on the moon.
Well, that's the whole thrust now.
Well, but it's not. That's the thrust of the press releases.
Right.
But when you actually look at the equipment, there is no plan for a single thing that can be used to build a permanent manned mission.
Do you think this is just an exercise to spend $100 billion?
Well, now, here's how the politics has been described to me. NASA had set up a plan that said we have to base everything we're doing on a new 100-ton cargo-carrying rocket. And when there was a change in NASA back in June and new people came on board, and a lot of people in the space community were hoping that we would abandon this idea of this great big sledgehammer of a vehicle that could carry 100 tons into orbit but then had to be tossed away. Nobody ever, in considering trying to achieve George Bush's plans, first of all, George Bush has to be given credit. He came up with a wonderful idea. Let's get back to the moon. Let's get to Mars. All of that is to his credit. Unfortunately, nobody came up with that. They stuck with the old assumption of a 100-ton liftoff vehicle. Now, that vehicle is going to cost us $8 billion to develop. And as I said, it'll carry 100 tons. There's another vehicle that's almost all ready to go. It's called the Shuttle C, meaning the cargo version of the shuttle. It looks very much like the space shuttle, except it carries entirely cargo. That will carry 60 tons into orbit and will cost $3 billion to develop. $5 billion, once upon a time a congressman said, once you're talking about $1 billion, you're talking about money.
Well, and this is going to be more than what they've estimated.
It's probably going to be more than what they've estimated, and the Shuttle C is almost there, so it would only cost an extra $3 billion to develop.
I'll tell you, Howard, what's so mind-boggling, though, is by the time we get back to the moon, about 50 years would have passed since we were last there.
Which is horrible, and one of the things that really depresses both Paul, again, Paul being my friend at NSF, Dr. Paul Verbos, one of the things that distresses us both the most is you're not developing any new technologies. You're not putting us any further ahead of the game. With the space plane, you put us way ahead of the game. And here's another bonus. There is an organization called the Air Force, and it spends an awful lot of money on planes. And it looks for planes that have a total global capacity. It's looking for planes that instead of having a 3,000 to 5,000-mile range, can go all the way around the globe, can actually accomplish several missions, and then can come back home again, and can do it over and over again. Well, this space plane does exactly many of the things that the Air Force is asking for. Now, the Air Force has a big budget, and NASA has a budget. If you combine those two budgets in the same vehicle, and you can with this reusable space plane, you save yourself a bunch of money.
Well, so nobody... Are you glad we're going back, though, Howard?
I am very glad we're going back. I'm just hideously disappointed that there's nothing new.
That it's going,
as you said, that it's a ton of money being spent, $104 billion, to take us exactly back where we were, with the exception of two extra men, back in 1969 to 1971.
See, I think the thrust should really be, let's go to Mars. Let's create the new enthusiasm for that. And, you know, maybe this going to the moon means they want to launch from the moon and go to the Mars. But to me, they've lost a lot in terms of public sentiment and support. They should have simply said, we want a mission to Mars, and they should have used that as the focal point.
Well, I agree with you, and I agree also that the moon can be very useful as a base from which to take off for Mars if, in fact, you do what the press releases that NASA put out 2 days ago said we were going to do, establish a manned presence, a permanent manned presence on the moon, do it in the area of the lunar caps, where it looks like we may be able to find water with which to make the fuel with which we will then get to Mars. Unfortunately, as I said, there is no permanent lunar presence. There is no sort of lunar base in this program. There is no sort of facility for turning lunar water, if there is such a thing, into fuel, and it doesn't get us anywhere toward Mars. It's unfortunately, how can you put this? When there's a lot of rhetoric that isn't reflected in the hardware you're talking about or in the long-term mission that you're talking about, and that rhetoric appears in the press releases, but it isn't supported with hardware, what would you call it? Flim-flam?
Some people have options in their cars, Howard, that they never use. They love to point them out to their friends, but they have no idea how they work. They don't even know why they're there, but they bought them anyway. What are we going to do with a station on the moon?
Well, again, if you did really have a station on the moon, you'd be demonstrating a human presence, a permanent presence in space, out of Earth orbit for the very first time ever. And if it manufactured fuel in order to get to Mars, that would be wonderful. And if it used lunar material, I mean, remember, you can launch a concrete structure from the moon to Mars, because the liftoff, what you need to lift off from the moon is very little in the way of fuel, and you can lift almost anything you want off. And if you wanted to do a Zubrin type thing and build your vehicles, your moon to Mars vehicles, out of the material available on the moon itself, all this stuff that would make a wonderful concrete, theoretically, you could fairly easily do it, but unfortunately, there's nothing of that sort in this plan.
Wouldn't you rather spend that money to cure cancer or to build better schools or even build roads that you don't have to block every day during rush hour traffic?
I don't think it's an either-or proposition, because way back in the 19th century, a guy named Frederick Jackson Turner, a historian, wrote something called the Frontier Hypothesis. And he said, what makes America unique is that America always has new frontiers to conquer. And a people always needs new frontiers to fire its imagination. The either-or question is sort of like saying to Cheops, the pharaoh, way, way back when in Egypt, we've got a choice here. Either you build your pyramid, or we take care of this incredible flooding problem we've got every single year in the Nile. Well, Cheops didn't see it as an either-or proposition. He saw it as both proposition. We learn how to take advantage of this incredible flooding that we've got in the Nile every year, and at the same time, we build a pyramid, and with that pyramid, we will uplift the human spirit, we'll set a new level of human aspiration, and from that new level of aspiration and imagination, all kinds of things will come tumbling like the gifts out of a piñata. And guess who was right? We're still looking up to the pyramids today.
Yeah, but was it worth the effort that probably went into building them a long time ago?
You and I would both have made sure that things were done far more humanely.
Yes.
And that far fewer humans would have suffered the way that they did back then. But what do we want to do without the pyramids? What do we want to do without projects like what the World Trade Center? Again, Osama bin Laden knew how important these symbols of our aspirations are, because he knew he would humble our spirits when he knocked one of them down. That means the highest things that you try to go for in life set your level of aspiration. And the culture always needs to be aspiring to new things.
You know, Howard, I have to have you back on because we're running out of time for a full show. I wanted to, you know how I always give you an assignment?
Right.
This time the assignment is, what is the value of a human soul? My case in point. My case in point.
I was hoping we'd get back to the human soul.
You know, my case in point is we lose 3,000 people during 9/11. We lose 300,000 people during the December 26th tsunami. 300,003 lives gone. They're all gone. What has happened to those souls? Think about that.
One, every soul is irreplaceable.
We'll have you back on again.
Okay, thanks, George. Have a good night.
Howard Bloom, the human computer, his thoughts on our plans to go back to the moon and then hopefully on to Mars. Up next, we're going to talk about illegal immigration. Our guest, Frosty Wooldridge, next up on Coast to Coast AM.